The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, my friends. It's Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide here, broadcasting this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show to all four corners of planet Earth. You are most welcome. Now, in today's episode, I am going to be travelling to the lush green county of Shropshire, which is actually a border county close to the border with Wales. And I'm going to the tiny village of Kinlet to explore some fabulous Tudor tombs with author and historian Elizabeth Norton. But before we get there, as ever, there are a couple of pieces of housekeeping. And just like last month, this month is set to be an extremely busy month. Not least because, of course, of the impending coronation coming our way on the 6th of May, and the fact that I am running the Coronation Summit in the middle of the month. Now, have you got your ticket yet? If not, let me tell you a little bit about it and how you can hop on board. Now, one of the reasons I was so inspired to put together this spring's virtual summit on coronation is that I know from the death of Queen Elizabeth last September time that there were so many questions people had about what they were seeing on their TV screens. And I anticipate that there will be just as many questions for the forthcoming coronation. And I thought it would be just fantastic if we could get some guest speakers to chat with me about many different aspects, the many different varied aspects of coronation and what exactly we're seeing and what to look out for. And so this year's summit is called Your Essential Guide to Coronation. We have Tracy Borman, who will be talking to us all about the history of coronation and its ceremony. We have Jonathan Foyle, architectural historian, talking to us about the buildings of coronation, particularly Westminster Abbey and Westminster Hall. I'm then joined by Nicola Tallis, author and historian, who is talking to us all about the regalia of coronation, particularly those glittering jewels that we will see on display. And finally, I head to the Royal School of Needlework at Hampton Court Palace to meet up with Aleary Lynn, who used to be the curator of historic dress at Hampton Court, and Anne Butcher, who is the head of studio there, to talk all about the robes of coronation. So I think by the end of the summit, we will have all angles covered. Now, yes, it is a little bit shorter than normal, but it is comprehensive and it is packed full of all the facts that you will need to be coronation ready when everything gets underway on the 6th of May. By the time this podcast goes live, there'll be just a few days left to book your tickets in the run-up to the event going live on the 15th. So I anticipate closing the ticket office on Monday the 12th of April. However, if you're listening to this podcast after the 15th of April and thinking, oh no, I missed it and I'd really love to hear those speakers, then worry not, because quite unusually, because we have a very specific event that this particular summit is wrapped around, I'm actually going to be reopening the Book It office again 1 week later on Saturday the 22nd of April, and you'll be able to buy your tickets right the way up to the coronation and for a week beyond, because I'm sure some of those questions will continue to linger, not only before, but after the event has gone live. So I know that sounds a little bit complicated. I'll put a summary of the description of when the ticket office will be open and closed in the description associated with this podcast, along with the link that you'll need to go and get all the information that you might want ahead of booking your ticket, and also on the same link where you can book your place. Now, with that done, it's time to get on with the show. So a couple of months ago now, on quite a cold, damp day, I headed into the county of Shropshire to liaise and meet up with author and historian Elizabeth Norton. Now, as you will hear in this podcast, Beth is somewhat of a specialist on the Blounts of Kinlet. Now, that name Blount, of course, will ring many bells with any Tudor lover. Bessie, of course, was the mistress of Henry VIII and delivered to him his sole male, albeit illegitimate, heir before, of course, Jane Seymour finally delivered the goods with the young Prince Edward. Beth suggested that we meet at the parish church of Kinlet, where she promised me we would see some amazing Tudor tombs. Well, I was a little bit sceptical because Kinlet is, well, in the back of beyond. But to be honest, my friends, I was blown away. This church is an extremely isolated spot, and the last thing that you would ever suspect is that you're going to be confronted with some glorious Tudor tombs, all relatives of Bessie Blount. Well, I'll let the story unfold from here. So, ladies and gentlemen, I give you Elizabeth Norton and the Blounts of Kinlet.
Hi, nice to see you.
Lovely to see you here too. Thank you so much for inviting me to Kinlet. Now, I must admit, as I was driving up here with Chris, who's here doing the recording with us today, we were getting more and more rural, and I saw this church in the distance on a hill and thought, goodness me, this place is really in the middle of nowhere. But we're here to talk about quite a prominent family from the Tudor period. So first of all, perhaps you should just introduce yourself and why you invited me here to Kinlet today.
I am Dr. Elizabeth Norton, and I write books on the Tudors primarily. And one of my books was on Bessie Blount, and my PhD thesis was on the Blount family, or the Blunt family. And the pronunciation really is an individual thing. Some modern Blounts or Blunts will swear that it's one way to pronounce it, and some will swear it's the other way. Even Tudor documents show that there are different pronunciations based on spelling. So we are here at Kinlet, which is the heart of Blount country.
Is that right? Okay. But it doesn't look like the heart of anything except the middle of a field at the moment. So maybe we could first of all just say where Shropshire is as a county in the country, for those people particularly overseas and might not be so familiar with English geography. And then why is it so isolated up here? I'm expecting a grand manor house or something similar.
So Shropshire is in the West Midlands in England, quite close to the Welsh border, very far from the sea. We are in the heart of sort of sheep country, rural countryside. We're about 6 miles or so from the Worcestershire border. There are a lot of different counties around here. There is a manor house. It's later than the 16th century. It's 18th century, and there would have been an earlier manor house here. But there's not much of a village left. When the Blounts were here in their heyday in the 16th century, you would have been absolutely surrounded by fields and cottages. We know there's a blacksmith's workshop here. There are 2.5 manors in the parish, half because half the manor is in another parish. Uh-huh. It was a busy, busy place, but now there's almost nothing. There's a few houses, I think there's a pub, there's a church, and there's the manor house. And that is because in the late 18th century, the decision was taken to clear the village by the landowner who wanted the fields for their livestock.
I see. That makes a lot of sense. So, dear listeners, if you do come on pilgrimage to Kinlet, you're inspired to do so by what you hear in this podcast today. As you approach the village, you will see a church up on the hill, and that's what you're heading for. It's the Church of St John the Baptist, right, Beth?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, right. And there's been a church here for how long? I mean, we're stood right outside of it at the moment. So when was this church founded?
So Kinlet's mentioned in the Domesday Book. In fact, it doesn't increase in size very much throughout the medieval period. There's presumably a church there then, but the church we're standing in front of is a medieval church. It's here in at least the late 13th century, and there are some 14th century tombs as well inside the church. So it's a medieval church. It's obviously been changed over time, but not a huge amount. It hasn't undergone a big Victorian restoration, which is always a good thing.
It certainly is.
They just absolutely strip out the fabric of churches. It was never a particularly wealthy area, so it's not a huge grand church. You can see sort of bits have been added to it piecemeal. It's got a tower. It's also got some wattle and daub on it. Up towards the top of the church, because it simply wasn't that wealthy. It's not particularly large, although it looks far, far bigger than the parish would currently need.
Now, you're right, that wattle and daub is just so unusual, really, in a church. You don't see that very often, so interesting to understand the origins of that. It's all about the cash. So why here? Why have you brought me to this church? What's so interesting about it from a Blount point of view?
So Kinlet was the primary Blount family manor, and this is where Bessie Blount will have spent large parts of her childhood. She may or may not have been born here. When she was born, her grandfather still occupied the hall, but it's central to the Blount family. And when we go inside the church, we're going to see some really important connections to Bessie and her immediate family.
Oh, it's just wonderful. I can't wait to get inside and I am interested in Bessie, but she's one of those shadowy figures. You know, everybody's read about her as Henry VIII's kind of acknowledged mistress. Of course, she gave birth to Henry Fitzroy, who Henry VIII recognised as his illegitimate son. And then she seems to get packed off, and you hear the odd Blount name popping up here and there. But I don't know much more about the family. What drew you to them? Why did you choose to study them?
So firstly, they're enormous. You can always find a Blount doing something interesting in the 16th century, because there are loads of them. Bessie is one of 11 siblings. Only three actually die young, so there are a lot of Blounts about. Her father is one of, I think, 7 sons, all of whom live to adulthood. So there are a lot of Blounts about. And they're interesting because they're a gentry family. So they're not nobility, they're below the rank of nobility, although the Barons Mountjoy are also Blounts from a more distant line, and they do interact with them. But they're wealthy, they're leaders of their county society. They actually don't come to court that often. So actually for Bessie to get a place at court in Queen Catherine's household and then to attract the king would be quite surprising, quite unusual for the family.
Oh, God, I've got so many questions to ask you. I'm going to try and remember them all. How did they get their wealth? Was it farming? Was it wool? How did the Blounts become wealthy?
So they are wealthy through their farming. They have a very large demesne at Kinlet, so they farm their own land themselves. We can see them in the 16th century trying to increase the value of their manorial tenancy, sometimes quite aggressively so. We get enclosure, which is, of course, a big issue of 16th century agriculture, where lords basically fence off the common land and stop the peasants using it. So it's primarily agriculture. They do have some interest in ironworking in the 16th century. They have some interest in salt vats in Worcestershire. But in general, they're earning their money from farming and also through marrying well.
Okay. That's always a good way to progress, isn't it? In medieval and Tudor England. So when did the Blounts first come to court? Who was at the Tudor court? Were they there during the reign of Henry VII? Can you tell us a little bit about that kind of background and their connections?
So we're in Shropshire, but we're also in prime Yorkist country.
Okay.
So the landlord of the neighbouring manor, Urnwood, which is also in the parish of Kinlet, belonged to the Earls of March, who, of course, Edward IV, the first Yorkist king, is also Earl of March.
Of course.
So it brings Urnwood into the crown. So they have a natural allegiance to the Yorkists, and we can see members of the family starting to have some contact with the royal family in the late 15th century. Thomas Blount, who is Bessie Blount's grandfather and is the owner of Kinlet, is the son-in-law of Sir Richard Croft, who's a very wealthy Herefordshire landowner and very, very close to the Yorkist royal family. He, in fact, raises the young Edward IV for a bit and his brother. So they're very, very close. Uh-huh. And it really brings the Blounts to the Tudor family through Elizabeth of York. But they're very, very minor. I mean, you know, they sort of appear at funerals and christenings and coronations, doing something really minor.
At the end of the procession.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's really Bessie's father, Sir John Blount, who seems to have been quite good looking, very well built, is appointed as one of Henry VIII's spears. And this is his ceremonial bodyguard that he creates at the start of his reign. And he basically wants to be like the French king. He wants these good-looking young men around him. You have to be fit. You have to be well-built to be one of the king's spears. And so Sir John Blount is. And crucially, to be one of the king's spears, you have to stay close to the king. Right, of course, you're his bodyguard. And we know that John brings at least some of his family, because children continue to be conceived and born during this period. And it's quite likely that's how his eldest daughter arrives at court.
And Bessie is the eldest daughter, is she?
She is. She definitely is. There has been some debate in the past about the birth order of the children, but I can categorically say that Bessie is the eldest daughter. I have a source. The family very conveniently signed up for a bede roll in Staffordshire during Bessie's childhood, where they listed their children, including deceased children, actually, in birth order. And it goes Thomas, a child that dies young, and then Bessie, Elizabeth.
So she's the oldest child, full stop.
Absolutely.
Not the oldest surviving child, anyway.
And, yeah, and quite a lot older than her eldest surviving brother. He's actually raised with her son. He's born in 1513. Bessie's born in around 14... We don't have her birthday. Mm-hmm. Earliest she can be born is about 1498. Mm-hmm. Latest is probably about 1501-ish, but she's probably born around the turn of the century.
So it's Bessie's father that brings her to court. At what date?
So Bessie arrives in around 1512, so she's about 13, 14 years old.
Oh, right. So she's quite young. So she's one of the sort of the maids of honour, I guess, yeah, to Catherine of Aragon.
Absolutely. So she's not a big lady in waiting. She's not going to be close to the Queen. But it's a real honour that she's been picked as one of these girls, actually. A step up socially. None of her sisters come anywhere near the court.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, you know, 15, sort of 12, that's only 3 years into Henry's reign. So he's still quite a young man, right, at this point.
He is. He's young and good looking. And he presides over a court that's actually really fun. You know, there's lots of dancing, there's lots of music, there's lots of dressing up. I mean, Henry VIII has so many costumes. It's going to be really, really fun.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So remind me how Bessie comes to Henry's attention and when. I can't remember the dates around that.
So it takes Bessie a while to catch the king's attention. The first record we have of her actually is in a letter written by Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, Henry's brother-in-law. Where he basically says, you know, can you recommend me to Mistress Carew, Elizabeth Carew, and Mistress Blount, so Bessie Blount, which sort of suggests that there's some sort of flirtation, some sort of involvement going on. Mm-hmm. Bessie then dances with the king at court at Twelfth Night, which again looks like, you know, there's possibly a relationship. But Henry is so discreet about his love affairs. It's really, really hard. It looks quite likely that Elizabeth Carew becomes his mistress first. So actually of the two, he selects Elizabeth Carew. Primarily because actually when we look through his wardrobe accounts, he is giving her some very, very rich gifts of clothing around this period, including sort of cloth of silver. In fact, some of the materials he's giving her, he's also giving the same fabrics to Catherine of Aragon.
Wow.
Which sort of suggests that Elizabeth Carew might just be a bit more than a friend.
I think you're probably right. And I love that reference to the letter by Charles Brandon. You can almost imagine him going, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, Henry.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, Bessie Blount is prime mistress material. You know, she is not going to marry the king. She's pretty low born, really. You know, they're gentry, but local gentry, you know, and this is way before Henry VIII starts marrying English women, you know. It's going to do the family some good if she becomes a king's mistress.
Yeah. So Elizabeth Carew is first. Do we know anything about how long that affair lasted before it dwindled, and whether it was Bessie that supplanted her immediately, or was there a period of time before Bessie caught Henry's eye?
So we don't know. she seems to be the mistress that comes next. The letter would suggest that they're both in the running. But again, Henry is so discreet about his love affairs. In fact, I mean, we only know for definite that he had two mistresses. And that is, of course, Bessie Blount, who bears his child, and Mary Boleyn, because actually he admits it. The other mistresses, you just have to kind of read between the lines, look at rumours. So he is really discreet.
And why do you think that is? Because, you know, it was sort of, particularly look across the channel to the French court, it was sort of quite an honour to be the king's mistress or maître en titre. What was different about the English court?
I think a lot of it's Henry's personality, and he's quite prudish. You know, for a king who's got six wives, that can seem quite strange. But actually, I mean, partly that's it. He marries women. He doesn't necessarily sleep with them. He actually gets married. He's an eternal optimist. You know, he's a romantic at heart. So I think it's partly that. He likes to keep it quiet. Early in his reign, he seems to have had something going on with a sister of the Duke of Buckingham, and that causes a real scene at court. And so, you know, perhaps he's sort of trying to keep it discreet. He also, he's not very generous with his mistress's families. Mary Boleyn's family get very little out of the relationship, and neither do the Blounts. Bessie's father isn't even knighted until towards the end of his life, at the end of the 1520s. So long after his daughter is no longer the king's mistress. He gets an advance on his wages as the king's spears, which is quite substantial, particularly as actually it's a point where Henry is considering disbanding the spears. So, you know, it looks more like a financial gift. Right. He also gets to share the stewardship of Bewdley with his father, which is a nearby town. That's actually basically all the Blounts get.
Oh, really? So Bessie becomes his mistress. How old is she when we think she probably became Henry's mistress?
So she's probably around 15 or 16. She's okay. Definitely a teenager.
Yeah.
So she's young.
It's funny because I always think of her as being in her 20s. So this is already just sort of resetting my picture, yeah, this whole story.
She's about the same age as Anne Boleyn, maybe a year or so older, probably, because of course we don't know when Anne Boleyn was born either. But yeah, I mean, I think that's always slightly mind-blowing for people. That, yeah. You know, you kind of think Bessie's an earlier generation, but actually she isn't at all. No. So she is very young. But Henry himself is quite young at this point as well. You know, he's in his 20s. He's very, very, you know, he's very good looking, very athletic.
Yeah, absolutely. So as any Tudor history lover will know, of course, that liaison resulted in a pregnancy. Can you tell us about the circumstances when that happened? How do we know? When do we first hear of this pregnancy?
So Henry is very discreet about the pregnancy, partly because it coincides with the end of Catherine of Aragon's last pregnancy in October 1518, when she gives birth to a stillborn daughter. Bessie will have been in the early stages of pregnancy by that stage. So it's all quite hushed up. Bessie last appears at court in October 1518. And she next emerges at Blackmoor in the Prior's House in Essex when she's given birth, probably in June 1519, to Henry Fitzroy. The baby is acknowledged immediately. Cardinal Wolsey is immediately there. He's his godfather. He's given the surname Fitzroy, which means son of the king. He's clearly, you know, immediately acknowledged. Henry's got no doubts about the father of this baby. So she's been kept in Essex, so out of the way of Catherine of Aragon, out of the way of the court. It's quite conveniently close to one of Henry's palaces, however, Newhall in Essex. And he actually then goes and spends a lot of the summer there, which I think is quite, suggests very firmly that he's visiting Bessie and his baby, because of course this is his only surviving son.
Yeah, and maybe you could just put that in context, because, you know, it might not have been that important, but for Henry, that was hugely important, wasn't it?
It's incredibly important. You can't sort of underestimate the importance of Henry Fitzroy's birth to Henry VIII, because he's been married by that stage for a decade to Catherine of Aragon. She is over 5 years older than him, and she doesn't conceive another child after the end of 1518. So although at this stage Henry probably hasn't given up on having children with Catherine of Aragon, they haven't got a great childbearing record. There are three sons born. One lives a few weeks, the others die at birth or before birth. There is one daughter that survives, Princess Mary, who's born in 1516. So Henry Fitzroy is Henry VIII's proof that it's not his fault. Yeah. It's not his problem, because, look, with another woman, here's this healthy baby boy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Beth, that is a great start to our story. And I'd love to come back and talk about what happens to Bessie Blount and what happens to Henry Fitzroy. But we are standing here on a rather cold January day. And the idea of heading inside and maybe seeing some of Bessie's relatives is the perfect one. So shall we go inside and maybe we can talk a little bit about her family before we come back and finish the story?
Excellent. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay, so, wow, this is such a great church. I mean, I have to say, there are some parish churches I go in excitement that I'm going to find some old tomb or some great architecture, and it's very disappointing, but not Kinlet Church. Can you describe, we're standing in the nave at the moment, maybe you could just describe some of what we can see.
Yeah, so, I mean, you will not be disappointed here. It's not the biggest church in the world. It looks very Norman with its rounded arches.
Yes.
So the nave is just a little bit bigger than the chancel. We've got a couple of side chapels as well. It's quite plain inside, actually. And again, that reflects the fact that it was never a hugely wealthy area. You know, it's not Norfolk with its, you know, great yes. wealth in English wool. It's, you know, it's very much agricultural country. So the arches are quite plain. But it's absolutely stunning, and there are some real treasures in here.
And those treasures we are going to see, because there are some tombs, aren't there, of some of Bessie's relatives, and I can't wait to go and explore
no,
them with you.
I mean, it's like Bessie Blount's family tree written in stone.
Oh, right, well, let's go. And as we walk, maybe you could just tell us, would this have been the church they would have come to then?
Absolutely, yeah. As far as we know, Kinlet Hall didn't have a chapel.
Right.
It wasn't particularly large. It's the largest building here, but, you know, again, they're not a hugely wealthy family. The hall was right next to the church, so almost certainly this is where the family will have worshipped.
I see. Well, wow, that's amazing, isn't it? It's mind-blowing. So there are a number of tombs we want to look at. Which should we go and have a look at first?
Shall we go and look at the earliest?
Go on.
Because this explains how the Blounts came to
Kinlet.
Well,
definitely. And as we're walking over there, I'd just like to say, dear listeners, that as ever, there will be a show notes page associated with this podcast. We're going to be taking lots of lovely photos of the tombs and the church. So please do look out for the link in the description, and perhaps you want to watch those, look at those pictures as Beth and I talk. Okay, so we've come into one of the side chapels, and there's clearly a very beautiful, if not very petite, medieval woman here. Tell me about her.
So it's lovely, isn't it? I mean, absolutely classic medieval.
Gorgeous. It's actually gorgeous. And I tell you what I really love, that you can get very close to it and look down on her face, because quite often tomb chests with effigies, you can't quite kind of get over and see their face. But here, It's been beautifully sculpted.
Absolutely.
Hasn't it?
Someone has spent a lot of money on this. You know, she's got a cushion which is being held by angels. Yeah. And then if we look down towards the folds of her dress, just inside her cloak, you can see a swaddled baby.
Is that a baby that died?
It is, yeah. And she most likely would have died in childbirth as well.
So who is this gorgeous lady?
So we don't know with absolute certainty, because unfortunately there are no surviving inscriptions, but she's most likely Isabel Cornwall. And Kinlet passed into the Cornwall family quite early. They're descended from King John through an illegitimate line, but gives the Blounts just this little kind of connection to royalty.
Okay.
Isabel is the heiress to Kinlet. She inherits Kinlet in the 15th century. And unfortunately, she dies young and her children also die. She probably dies in childbirth.
Yeah.
But because Isabel dies, Kinlet passes to her aunt, who's married into the Blount family. And this is when the Blounts, who are an Oxfordshire family, in fact, they come from Deddington in Oxfordshire, come to Kinlet for the first time. And this is when they move up socially, because before that, they've owned one small manor in the parish of Deddington in Oxfordshire.
Right.
But this is where they become real leaders of county society. So she's really, really important. But it's such a sad tomb.
It is.
It's beautiful, but then you see the baby and you see how young she is.
You can clearly see she's a teenager, I would say.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you? She looks like a teenager.
Very, very young. And somebody clearly loved her.
Yeah.
You know, to pay for this tomb and to commission this tomb.
Yeah. And she's got gorgeous, this is what I love about tombs. You get to see the real clothes, the actual clothes. Gorgeous headdress that she's got on here. How would you describe that?
So it looks like a hairnet almost. You know, you can see the sort of the lace work around it. You know, I can kind of imagine that would be picked out in gold maybe.
Yes.
Really, really ornate, the decoration there. And her dress is so simple. You know, when we see pictures of medieval women in these sort of simple, quite figure-hugging dresses, it's absolutely that.
This is it.
She's really stylish.
Yeah.
She's really attractive. I mean, it's such a lovely tomb.
She's so pretty. You can see she's genuinely a beautiful young girl, beautiful young woman. Oh my goodness, that's lovely. Do we think she's actually buried here underneath this, or do you think this has been moved here?
The tombs have moved quite a bit. So she's most likely not under here.
Right.
I don't think we have records actually where this one was originally, but certainly they've been moved around quite a bit.
Yeah.
And one of the Blount family tombs is originally also in this chapel and has since moved. So
what was the reason for moving them around?
I think just they felt like it, really, to be honest. The Blount family successors, who are descended from the Blounts, want to kind of emphasise just how important the family were. So they kind of push the tombs a bit more into the chancel.
Oh, one thing I did mean to ask you, what kind of period date are we looking at here with Isabel, did you say?
Yeah, Isabel, 15th century.
Okay, 15th century, right. So that's Isabel. And so the parish of Kinlet has come into the Blount family. Now who do we need to go and meet?
So the next is Sir Humphrey Blount.
Oh, I love that name.
Elizabeth Winnington. I love the name Humphrey. It's so archaic.
Humphrey.
Nobody is called Humphrey anymore, and they should be.
I know, I totally agree with you.
So here we have Sir Humphrey Blount and his wife Elizabeth Winnington on a very grand tomb chest. And they've got their children as weepers around the tomb chest, as well as some religious figures. They have the sons in the kind of the most prominent side, and then they have daughters around the edges.
So we're now in the chancel area, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
So we're right up in front of the high altar. We've got a tomb chest here, two effigies. Sir Humphrey next to, what did you say?
Elizabeth Winnington.
Elizabeth Winnington. And again, what kind of period are we talking about here?
So Humphrey dies in 1477. Elizabeth lives into the 16th century. Actually, Bessie Blount will have known her, probably. Blounts are also really long-lived. Elizabeth will have known quite a few of her great-grandparents.
Right. Wow. So can you tell us a little bit about the effigy? Very low-cut gown she's got on here.
It is, isn't it? It is. Yes. No, it's quite. And she is likely to have commissioned this tomb because Elizabeth outlives her husband, Humphrey Blount.
Right.
She's quite a forceful woman. At one stage, actually, she sues her own son over the payment of her dower, which is her widow's pension. So she definitely is a woman that knows her own mind.
A formidable woman, absolutely. What do we know of any particular events associated with Sir Humphrey or Elizabeth that we should know about?
So Sir Humphrey is, towards the middle part of his career at least, a confirmed Yorkist. And actually, if we look at his effigy, we can see him wearing a collar with the Yorkist motif of the sun.
Ah, yes, I see it.
So he's displaying, or at least his wife is having displayed, his Yorkist sympathies, his Yorkist allegiance, which isn't actually that surprising in 1477,
of course.
That's
right, in the Wars of the Roses,
absolutely,
aren't we?
Yeah. Absolutely. He fights at a few battles in the Wars of the Roses. He is very much linked to the Yorkist royal family.
Yeah. And this tomb, quite typical of the period, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a grand one, actually. I mean, it shows, you know, sort of how aspirational the family are. Elizabeth Winnington has brought a bit of money into the family. So it's a grand tomb and shows how revered he was, at least by, you know, surviving relatives. Because actually what's quite interesting is their son and heir, Thomas, doesn't have a tomb in Kinlet Church. And he actually leaves money in his will asking for a tomb to be built, presumably expecting one like this.
Yes.
Unfortunately, in his will, he also tries to disinherit his eldest son, Sir John Blount, who's Bessie Blount's father. Ah. John then has to go to litigation to get Kinlet back into his line of the family. And I suspect he then decides he's not going to build his father a tomb.
It's kind of up yours.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. It's like, well, you can't have a tomb. Yeah. So Thomas Blount is presumably somewhere
under the floor
here, but he didn't get his stone of marble and his effigy of a knight, which he asked for in his will.
I love that story. So before we just move on, you mentioned the weepers, and I just wanted to kind of emphasise that for people who are coming to look at tombs, to look out for the weepers, because these were, as you said, they were often family members, weren't they, depicted as small figures around the base of the tomb.
Yeah, absolutely. So they're mostly a couple's children. And what's really interesting, actually, because actually up to about the middle of the 20th century, there was a real sort of strand of history which said that people before the modern period didn't love their children. It was very, very different. But actually, I would say weepers really show that they did, because actually most couples will put all of their children on their tomb chest, regardless of how long they lived. So it's very, very common to see huge numbers of children. You know, a couple that we know, you know, we would know had five children, say, will have 12 children on their chest, because they put all of their babies on. And normally they age them up to adulthood. They don't always. There's actually a Blount family tomb in Kidderminster Church where the children that have died young are depicted as babies.
You're right.
But some of the children around this base will have died in infancy. What's quite interesting about their weepers as well is if you look at the end, to the right, sort of underneath Elizabeth Winnington's head, they have an angel looking at their children.
Yes, they do. You can very definitely see the wings associated with the angel. I'd love to go around the side and just have a look at the ladies as well, because you said round here?
Yeah, so we've got some daughters around here.
Are they? Oh, here they are.
So they look like very fine late medieval ladies.
Aren't they beautiful with their gorgeous headdresses? And they're holding what looks to be is that a book that someone of them's got?
Yeah, some have got books, yeah.
They seem to be leaning on shields. Would that have been...
They once would have had their arms painted on to show the families they married into.
Right, and that's a good point, isn't it? Because, of course, these just look like plain alabaster-type tombs now, but they would have been highly painted
in the day. Absolutely, yeah.
Mm. And what does this tell us? Because often the feet of the effigy, you will often see some kind of beast of some description. what does that tell us? And we've got a lion. Look at that expression.
It's a very grand lion. Humphrey's resting his feet on top of.
What do we need to know about these?
So it's a heraldic beast. He's selected that, you know, as his heraldic symbol. And he's gone for a lion. Interestingly, his grandson has a dog instead on the opposite tomb.
Well, that's a good link, isn't it, over to the other tomb, because directly opposite on the other side of the chancel, we've got almost identical looking tomb here. Tell us about this tomb.
This is the tomb of Sir John Blount and his wife, Catherine Peschel. And these are the parents of Bessie Blount.
That's amazing. That's fantastic, isn't it? I've got to get up close and have a look at Sir John here.
Thank you. is also wearing a Yorkist collar. He has the S symbol on his collar, which again is just demonstrating, even, you know, long after the Wars of the Roses, you know, that he's still a true Yorkist. And of course, Henry VIII is, as far as most people are concerned, the heir to the House of York. Not everyone, but most people. So, you know, it's entirely proper.
Yeah, yeah. So by this time, we've not got the tension of York and Lancaster. Of course, we've had the fusion of the houses of York and Lancaster. So it's kind of okay to display your sort of roots of your loyalty?
Absolutely. And there's no indication that they, you know, the Blounts were anything other than loyal to the king. You know, they're actually so relatively low ranking that actually, you know, being loyal to the king is very, very sensible.
Yeah, yeah. I love his haircut. He's got a bit of a bowl haircut, hasn't he?
Yeah, someone.
Bless him. I think he needs a good hairdresser, but that's another point. And so you were pointing out there's a dog. What a dog.
Yeah.
Look, again, the face is incredible.
I always think it looks a bit like a dachshund, but it's sort of quite a fierce one.
He does. He's like...
He's a bit they've even picked out the fur, which is just amazing.
It's wonderful, isn't it? Is this marble or is this alabaster?
Alabaster.
It is alabaster, yeah. I notice this one has an inscription around the side that we don't have on the other two.
That's right.
Do you know what that says, Beth?
So it references, you know, that it's John Blount's tomb and Catherine Pesher, and talks about their ancestry. She was a very significant Staffordshire heiress. Also struggles to obtain her inheritance, actually, and both of them get disinherited, which I think possibly says something about them. She is the daughter of Sir Hugh Peshel, who is a knight. He's often slightly on the wrong side of the law, sort of bringing war parties and invading people's houses and things like that. But he is one of four knights who are selected by Lord Stanley before the Battle of Bosworth Field to go and shore up Henry Tudor's vanguard. Because Lord Stanley, of course, tries to sit out the battle because he can't commit either side. But he sends these knights, and one is Catherine's father. He dies when she is very, very young. And so she's technically the heiress to her grandfather, Humphrey Peshel, who is a big Staffordshire landowner. But he then takes a much younger wife, a wife who's about Catherine's age, and has another son. And so very strenuously attempts to disinherit her. So there's a long and very complicated law case. But they do eventually acquire the manors, which is really where the Blounts become quite grand and very, very wealthy.
Right. And they certainly are wearing very fine clothes. So we've got Sir John is in his, he's chosen to be shown in his armour with his sword by his side. And I love what she's wearing. So when was this tomb actually constructed?
So John dies in 1531. He actually dies in London when he's serving in Parliament. And he's buried at Blackfriars in London.
Right.
And a tomb is paid for there. The dissolution of the monasteries then happens, and the church is closed for a long time. And eventually the monuments are sold off. So at some point after that, so towards the end of the 1540s when the monuments are sent off, Catherine has died in 1541 herself. At some point, probably their son, Sir George Blount, has John's body moved from London to Kinlet and constructs a tomb. So it probably dates from the 1550s.
Right. And I love on her effigy, she's got the false sleeves there with little puffs of the linen coming through and the frills. And this is lovely, isn't it? Hanging down from the girdle belt, the carving on this, I don't know what you would call this, but it's obviously a jewel at the end of a girdle belt, and it's just beautifully carved.
She looks amazing. I mean, her gable hood is fantastic, and completely of the period as well, because this is not carved when women were wearing gable hoods.
No, that's what I was going to say.
So someone has gone to a great deal of effort to depict this couple as they would have appeared, and tomb effigies aren't always likenesses. You know, there are plenty of contracts for tomb effigies where people say, I just want to be depicted as a knight. But I would say someone has gone to a lot of effort with these two to depict them as they will have appeared. At least with the dress. I mean, we can't say about the face, but...
Yeah.
And so it's just absolutely exquisite. We can see the jewels, we can see the lacing pulled through on her sleeves. It's just, I mean, honestly, it's like a portrait.
So yes, and on around her neck, she's got three bands of necklace, I presume gold thread, and a gorgeous pendant that's been beautifully carved. And then I don't know what you'd call this round her neck, but it looks like she's got a partlet on and it's just got lovely sort of lacing around the neck.
I mean, such a rich costume. I mean, if she owned jewels and dresses like this, which presumably she did,
yeah,
you know, she clearly was a very wealthy, very fashionable lady.
Yeah, fantastic. And even a little Tudor rose here, look on the fastening.
Yeah.
Isn't that fantastic?
And she was a really formidable woman as well.
Was she another formidable
woman? Absolutely.
This seems to be coming through.
We have a letter written by her to Thomas Cromwell, where she tries to get him to overturn an election result where her son had stood for Parliament and then didn't get elected, and she thought that was very unfair. So could Thomas Cromwell just overturn it and they can hold the election again? She pays Thomas Cromwell a pension, which I suspect is to sort of ease,
yes,
so that she gets what she wants, really.
Yeah. Now, before we move on, again, I noticed that there are some weepers around here, but I think you were saying there's something special about these weepers, Beth.
Yes, so we have their 11 children depicted as weepers, and we have the 5 boys underneath John and the 6 girls underneath Catherine. And what's really interesting, you have to sort of squeeze around the side of the tomb chest to see the daughters because they're quite close to the wall of the church. But if you look at the row of 6 daughters, the first daughter in the line is Bessie Blount. And we don't have a portrait of Bessie. The only other image we have of Bessie is a memorial brass that she commissioned at Southkyme Church in Lincolnshire, which is now in the British Museum. You can see it in the British Museum. It shows her as a sort of more mature lady. She's reading a book. She looks quite serious. Whereas this is Bessie in her youth. And again, weepers aren't usually intended to be portraits. So I think it's a leap to say this is Bessie as she would appear. But what I would say about the 6 daughters is considerable effort has been gone into to make the daughters look distinct. They've all got different poses, they have different faces. And given the work to make their parents look so distinct and so as they may have appeared in life, I think, you know, there is an essence of Bessie in this image.
I think they are beautiful. They're all wearing gable hoods, aren't they? But they've got the square cut neckline. They've got the features of the folded back cuffs on their gowns. They're beautiful.
They're stunning, aren't they? Absolutely. And again, I mean, they're not necessarily drawn from life in that the second sister, Anne, dies young.
Right.
So, you know, she's been aged up. She's shown as an adult here.
Yeah.
But the work that's gone into them. And actually, I think Bessie's is the best, the most detailed face, actually, of all 6 of them.
And I'm just going to ask, I can see there's a scroll with some writing on. Have we been... it's very difficult to see what that writing is now. In your studies, were you able to make that out?
So the scrolls are their first names. They're almost illegible. You can just about see, sort of, I think, the F of Elizabeth at the end, or
right,
the B. Just about, particularly when you sort of you take a picture with it and sort of look at it.
Uh-huh.
And you can see Anne or Anna in the next one.
I love those. I think I'm in love. They're fantastic.
They're gorgeous, aren't
they? And they're easy to miss because, as you say, they're round the back of the tomb. So, dear listeners, if you do come and have a look at these tomb chest, make sure that you squeeze round the back to find Bessie Blount. She's the first weeper as you get round the back of the tomb. Okay, so those are the 2 tombs in here.
Yep.
Where are we going next? Because I think there's one more to see.
We are, so we're going off to another side chapel, and this tomb is quite something.
It's amazing. Oh, that is almost scary. I'll tell you what I find scary. It's the fact that those 2 kneeling figures are clearly life-size.
Yep.
They're pretty life-size, aren't they? And they're sort of staring out at you under this incredibly ornate canopy. Who am I looking at here?
So this is Sir George Blount, who is the son of John and Catherine Peschel. He is the brother of Bessie Blount. He's quite a bit younger than her. Their eldest son dies, and then they have daughter. I mean, they must have been getting a bit worried.
Okay.
But so George is born in 1513. He's actually raised with Henry Fitzroy, so benefits from a really, really good humanist education, and more than he would expect. He marries Constance Talbot, who's shown on as the second large kneeling figure.
And is she a Talbot, the Shrewsbury Talbot?
She is. She's a cousin of the Shrewsburys.
Ah, okay.
So it's a good marriage. Actually, their marriage contract survives with his mother arranging it. And it's a good marriage. Unfortunately, it's a very unhappy marriage.
Why is that?
George, in general, nobody actually has a good word to say about George.
Oh, dear.
George is a character. And in fact, I mean, almost universally disliked, to the extent that when he was told to raise troops to fight with Henry VIII in the 1540s, to raise troops from his estate, only one of his tenants would come.
Oh, goodness me.
He frequently appears in litigation. There's one where he seems to have ordered his servants to cut someone's arms off, who then survives and then makes a complaint to Star Chamber. Interestingly, not about the arms, about the fact that George's pigs have been eating his crops.
Oh, my goodness.
This is all just background information. George is fairly universally disliked. Constance obtains a legal separation from him that the Privy Council negotiates. So although, of course, they're still married, you know, you can't get a divorce in Tudor England, they are separated legally and he has to maintain her.
And that's quite unusual, isn't it, for a wife to be able to do that? So that must say an awful lot about his character.
I think it quite likely does. There's actually a ghost story about George, which I would say probably shows his continuing reputation in the local area. And partly because his tomb is quite creepy. But the story goes that in the 17th century, some women were washing clothes in a pool just next to the church when George Blount rode out of the pool on a ghostly horse and then rode into Kinlet Hall, round the dining table where his heirs were all eating their dinner, and then back into the pool. And he did it so often that they actually exorcised the ghost, put his spirit into a bottle, they then hid in his tomb.
Oh, my word, that's a great story. Now, speaking of tomb, I think we should just talk a little bit more about this tomb. Could you describe, again, dear listeners, there will be pictures, but we've got the kneeling figures in life in all of their... he looks like he's more like an Elizabethan gentleman here. So an Elizabethan sort of with their ruffs and so on. But then we've got a memento mori underneath.
Yes, we have a transy.
Oi.
So George died in 1581. So, you know, the peak of his career is in the Elizabethan period. And he's very wealthy and very prominent. So he's shown as he appeared in life on the top of his tomb. It's a double-decker tomb. He's shown next to his wife, who's depicted as a very grand Elizabethan lady. We have their children depicted as smaller figures in between their parents. We have their son, John, who is holding a skull to indicate that he died young. And he, unfortunately, seems to have died choking on an apple, which, you know, is obviously a really tragic event. Their daughter, Dorothy, survived George, but she marries a low-born man without her father's permission and seems to have been disinherited. She makes strenuous efforts to obtain Kinlet and the other Blount family manors, but is ultimately unsuccessful. And actually, it passes to her cousin, Roland Lacon, who is the son of George's sister, Agnes.
Oh, right.
But what's really particularly creepy about this tomb is if you look below the kneeling figures, there is sort of, it's like a cage. Where a tomb chest should be, it's hollowed out with metal grills. And if you peek inside, you can see George as he became. So we have a shrouded figure. We have a transy effigy or a cadaver. It's in quite an early state of decomposition. So, you know, sort of a bit shrunken. He's in his in his shroud. Not completely skeletal. There is actually another Blount family tomb at nearby Mamble where it, the body is depicted completely as a skeleton. But it's, you know, it's a memento mori image. It's saying, you know, such as you are, so once was I. Such as I am, so shall you be. And it really... it's there to shock viewers and to make them pray for the individual. And I mean, that would really accord with George's beliefs because George is a Catholic.
Thank you.
But am I right in saying, I mean, the Transi tomb seemed to me to have been more popular in the sort of medieval period. And here we are in the late Elizabethan period. Would this be one of the later ones of that sort of fashion, or were they still producing Transi tombs at that time?
So they're really rare in the Elizabethan period. There's a handful of Transi tombs and big stone ones. There's probably only about three or four. In the Elizabethan period, you get some memorial brasses and some sort of carved reliefs that will show transies. They have a bit of a resurgence in popularity in the 17th century. John Donne in St. Paul's Cathedral famously posed for his cadaver monument in his lifetime. And actually, that survives. It was in Old St. Paul's. It's one of the few monuments that survives because it's standing sort of, you know, in a shroud with his arms close to his body, and basically with the fire, it just torpedoed through the floor and survived the fire. So, you know, actually there's a logic there to having a Transi effigy. Yes. But yes, they are quite rare. They still exist. Robert Cecil has one at Hatfield Church, for example. But they are quite a rare choice, quite an archaic choice. Very evocative. And I mean, I would suggest it's quite evocative of his Catholic faith and the fact that, you know, he wants intercessory prayers, he wants to be sped through purgatory, and probably George was going to spend a while in purgatory given maybe, some of his conduct.
Maybe he realised that towards the end. There's some really interesting other sort of heraldic bits and pieces and symbols. There's this sort of very strange sort of eternal loop, these sort of three petals all interwoven. That just looks really odd. I mean, you said it actually before we were recording. It looks a bit Masonic.
It does, yeah, it does. And some of the symbolism is really interesting. I don't think anyone has ever really set out to decode it. But certainly, I mean, when we think of sort of Rushton Triangular Lodge, for example, which is, you know, a building writ large in Catholic symbolism, I mean, you know, I would suggest that there is some Catholic mysticism in this symbolism.
Yeah, and we've got a boar's head here. Was that part of the family emblem, or is that something that we don't really understand why that's on there?
Yeah, I don't really understand. It's not part of their emblem. It looks like it's coming out of flames, I would say. So there's also some initials. So we've got GB in a few places for George Blount, but it's really interesting.
And this, I don't even know how to begin to describe that.
That is the Blount family emblem of the sun and a slipper.
A slipper? Yep. I would have never known.
Yes, so that's quite an unusual emblem. That is, in fact, a heraldic emblem.
Ah, well, thank you for telling me that, because I really would have known. And unlike the other tombs, I can see there is some remnants of the original paintwork. It hasn't completely been lost off this, has it?
Yeah, it once would have been very well painted. And when it's a brighter day, you can really see the colours, particularly in the clothing. So Dorothy, the daughter's cloak, is still quite red. So it once would have been really, really bright.
Oof. So we have met in this church Bessie's great-grandfather.
Yes.
Her father.
Yeah.
And her brother.
That's it.
Wow. Now, I think this is the perfect time to actually go back to our story that we were telling outside. Obviously, Bessie has given birth to an illegitimate son, but recognised by Henry VIII. She's was sent off to Blackmoor in Essex to have this child. What happens to her then?
So this is quite interesting in that we know from a later document that Bessie's daughter, Elizabeth Talboys, we know when Elizabeth Talboys was born roughly. And she was born a year after her brother, Henry Fitzroy, pretty much to the month. Bessie clearly conceives a child within about 3 months of Henry Fitzroy's birth. Now, this is before she's married off. Henry VIII is in the area.
Oh.
I mean, I think, you know, the implication is there that this may be a full sister rather than a half sister of Henry Fitzroy.
Ah.
Henry doesn't acknowledge her. There are signs that he shows an interest in Elizabeth Talboys later in life. She actually inherits the Talboys family property unexpectedly. Her grandmother, Lady Talboys, is outraged by this, and there's a lot of law courts litigation about it. Henry VIII actually steps in. He also steps in when Elizabeth has a falling out with her husband. And her husband tries to claim her inheritance for himself. And actually, Henry VIII steps in and says, nope, Elizabeth gets it. So I think there are clues, possibly.
That sounds very likely that there was something going on there.
But as a daughter, it doesn't matter. She doesn't count. Henry's got daughters, doesn't need another one.
Exactly. So he didn't need to do the whole thing of recognising her. That's fascinating. And what happens to Elizabeth after that? How long does she live? How long does Bessie Blount live for?
So Bessie is married off to Gilbert Talboys, and that's by 1522. And he becomes Lord Tailboys. He's a nobleman. It's quite a good marriage for her. It's quite a good marriage for him, because in agreeing to marry Bessie, he is given, well, the king orders an act of parliament where Gilbert's father is declared a lunatic and Gilbert gets to inherit all of his property early.
Right.
So Bessie and Gilbert are sort of living it up in fine style up at South Kyme in Lincolnshire, while poor old Gilbert's father is on a sort of lesser manor, possibly incarcerated. But they, yeah, it, by all accounts, seems to have been a happy marriage. They have, as well as Elizabeth Tailboys, there are two sons that survive. Bessie remains in contact with Henry Fitzroy, actually. His tutor writes to her. She also, actually, quite interestingly, his cast-off clothes, when he outgrows his clothes, they're sent to George Tailboys, his half-brother, which I always think is a really sweet detail.
That is
shows
sweet.
The two brothers in contact.
Yeah.
And Bessie seems to have visited Henry Fitzroy. She's no longer the king's mistress, but there's clearly no bad blood between them. Mm-hmm. She's on the New Year's gift list. She clearly has influence with the king, and people will speak to her about whether she can influence the king. They co-parent quite nicely.
Right.
She is widowed in the 1520s. And actually her name then starts to be mentioned around the king, because of course Henry doesn't have a son, a legitimate son. When he starts to try to annul his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, word gets around, you know, he's trying to marry an English woman. And at least on the continent, a lot of people get quite confused about who this is and sort of say, well, that will be Elizabeth Blount, will it? That will be the mother of his illegitimate son. And are quite surprised when it isn't, because actually, if he marries Bessie, who's now a widow, he gets a ready-made Prince of Wales. He can legitimise Henry Fitzroy, declare him Prince of Wales. He'll probably have more children, because Bessie's the same age as Anne Boleyn, or maybe a year or so older.
Yeah.
So it's a neat solution, but not one that Henry wanted to take.
Because he's madly in love with Anne Boleyn at this
Absolutely.
Point.
He's not getting rid of Catherine of Aragon to marry Bessie Blount. He wants Anne. Yeah. But marrying Bessie would have made a lot of sense.
Yeah, completely. I had never, ever thought of that. But yeah, that seems like such the logical thing to do. And can you imagine all the lives and the bloodshed and the angst that would have been saved if he'd just gone ahead and done that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although, having said that, of course, Henry Fitzroy didn't live that long, did he?
Actually, in many respects, Bessie's success as a mother is short-term. It doesn't actually last. Henry Fitzroy dies in 1536 as a teenager. Her sons by Gilbert Tailboys also die young. So Elizabeth Tailboys is Gilbert's heir, which does seem to cause some problems. She then remarries, and she marries Edward Clinton, who will eventually become Earl of Lincoln. He's sort of her toy boy, if you like. She's quite a bit older than him. She has three daughters by him, and then she disappears. She's presumably died. She seems to be dead by the time her mother makes a will in 1540, because there's no reference to Bessie,
right.
But there is to all her other living daughters and to Bessie's children.
Right, okay. So we think Bessie dies when?
Around 1539, around 1540, this is around the time her youngest daughter was born. So if I had to guess, I would say she died in childbirth.
Right, okay. And where do we think that happened?
We don't know, possibly really? London. We don't know where she's buried. She just disappears. She becomes, with the death of Henry Fitzroy, she becomes relatively irrelevant.
Yeah, so I think that's how I always think of Bessie Blount, sort of just disappearing. But you've shed so much interesting light on little snippets of that story that I just hadn't appreciated before. A lot to think about there. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. It's been really fun. It's always great to be able to talk about the Blounts.
You know, learning about something that you don't put a lot of time on, for me, that's really, really interesting. And I'm sure the listeners who've been tuning in will feel exactly the same. Now, you talked about your book, of course, so people can go and read about some of the things we've been talking about today.
Yeah, absolutely. So probably about 10 years ago, I wrote a book on Bessie Blount, which is, you know, really the only biography of her. Since then, I've updated my research a bit. So, you know, if you're really keen, you can always go and look up my PhD thesis, which is on the wider Blount family. And I think they're really interesting.
Yeah, they really are. So folks, go and look up Bess's book. It's called Bessie Blount?
It is, yeah. It's Bessie Blount.
So there you go. Easy to find. And what else are you up to, Beth? Is there anything else you want to let people know about how they can get in touch with you or any talks or what you're writing currently?
Yeah, so I'm very active on Twitter. So look me up on Twitter. If you're on there, I'm E. Norton History, and I've just been commissioned to write an academic biography of one of Henry VIII's wives.
Ooh.
So very excited about that. So watch this space.
Okay, excellent. We will. Well, thank you for bringing me to Shropshire and this quite amazing church. I really hope, folks, if you are in this part of the country, that you'll think about adding Kinlet to your list, because you will not be disappointed by some of the tombs that you find here. Oh, and by the way, just before we go, you mentioned Bewdley, a lovely little town, isn't it?
It is. It's really pretty, really quaint.
So if people were coming up here, it'd be quite nice maybe to stay at Bewdley and possibly come and...
Yeah, it's 3 miles down the road. Really lovely. Lots of nice places to stay. Lots of sort of old pubs and things. Really lovely place to visit. Yeah. Otherwise, the nearest town is Kidderminster, which is not quite as picturesque.
Yes, so I gather. And of course, I'm just going to add this just out of interest. I wrote a blog about Tickenhill Palace, which of course used to sit on the hill overlooking Bewdley. And I think that's where Prince Arthur got betrothed to Catherine of Aragon.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. So you can sort of see what's left of that. Actually, Bessie's family, her father was a steward of Bewdley. So, I mean, it's possible that the family also spent time in the palace as well.
Oh, well, that's a perfect excuse then to go to Bewdley and have a little look around and go and see if you can find the old palace. So if you are interested in finding out about Tickenhill Palace, I do have a blog. And again, I'll put a link in the description associated with this podcast. Okay, well, I think we're done. Thank you so much, Beth. It's been lovely to meet you up here.
You're welcome. It's been a real pleasure.
Fantastic. Thank you. Well, that's a huge thank you to Beth Norton for showing me this incredible place. It really is well off the beaten track. But if you are visiting Shropshire, perhaps going to see Ludlow Castle, where Prince Arthur died, or the wonderful Stokesay Castle, which is a glorious example of an early moated medieval manor house, then you might consider being a little bit more adventurous and intrepid and heading well off the beaten track. It is a bit tricky to find the parish church, but I urge you to give it a go. You will not be disappointed. Okay, my friends, well, once again, thank you for supporting my work and being a member of The Ultimate Guide. I hope you've enjoyed this member-only episode. And of course, I'll be back next month with another episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Until then, take care, and I'll see you on the road again soon. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling!